Hey, I'm Danny Levy, and you're listening to Digital Transformation and Leadership. This is the show where we go behind the scenes with today's top business leaders to understand how they're digitally transforming their company. This week, I'm joined by Girish Redekar, CEO and founder of Sprinto. Girish, welcome to Digital Transformation and Leadership.
Thanks, Daniel. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. And we're in similar time zones, which is always a benefit to me. You're in India, I'm here in Singapore. So before we get into it today, it'd be really good if you could introduce yourself and what it is you're doing.
So I'm the co-founder and CEO of a company called Sprinto.com. And at Sprinto, we help other B2B SaaS companies become compliant with these information security frameworks like SOC 2, ISO 27001, GDPR, HIPAA, PCI. And if that sounds like an alphabet soup, I don't blame you. So the simplest way to understand this is that if you are selling B2B SaaS software today, SaaS fundamentally means that my data is on your servers, mm-hmm. and I increasingly want some assurance that you're keeping this data safe and secure. So, these are frameworks that allow you to create assurance for me that, hey, you are following some standard security best practices, and by the use of which you are going to keep my data safe and secure. So these are becoming increasingly important if you're selling any sort of business software today. And typically these things take months of your CTO time or CISO time. Sprinto automates a bunch of things that would otherwise be done manually and gets you there in about 1/10 the effort. This is not my first SaaS company. Before this, I ran another B2B SaaS company called RecruiterBox, grew it to more than 2,500 customers, most of who were in the US. And funnily, I experienced the pain point that we solve in Sprinto while I was running RecruiterBox. So that was one of the things that happened. But that's a little bit about me. I'm a developer first, most comfortable when I'm writing code. But yeah, as a founder, I end up doing a lot of other things that SaaS companies would require to do.
Mm-hmm. When you had that aha moment, did you act on it immediately, or you had to put it to one side and come back to it later?
Honestly, yeah, there was no aha moment at the time we were facing this problem. Like, we just got super pissed with it, and we just wanted to get it out of the way. And when we eventually, RecruiterBox got acquired, and we took about a year and a half break before deciding what to do next. And we had about a half a dozen ideas that we were looking at. But this sort of stood out a little bit because we had gone through that pain personally before, that I had seen this happen before. So mm-hmm. the aha moment happened virtually like 3 or 4 years later, where we said that, this is an interesting problem, and I suspect a lot of other startups have the same problem that we do. So that happened a lot more in hindsight than, at the time when the actual event happened.
So the topic we're going to get into for today is all around, how to navigate the challenges of building a SaaS company and what it takes to be successful. But just before we get into that, I thought I'd ask you an icebreaker question. Always very interested to know, and this has been front of mind for me recently, is if you had an extra hour in the day, a 25th hour, what mm-hmm. would you do with that extra time?
That's a great question. I guess I would spend that hour with my son. So I have a 4-year-old, and I feel like I don't spend enough time with him, what with the startup and stuff like that. So I definitely, if I had an extra hour, I try and spend more time with him.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, the topic we're going to get into is how to navigate the challenge of building a SaaS company from the bottom up. And what it takes to attract a massive user base. And I was really keen to discuss this with you today, Girish, because you've been there and done it with your previous company, RecruiterBox, as you touched on earlier. So I think it'd be wonderful if you could walk us through the ups and downs of your whole journey.
So RecruiterBox was quite tough at the beginning. And, just for some context, I and my co-founder, when we decided to do something, we didn't even know that what we are going to do is called a startup. So we just had a bunch of ideas, and we thought, hey, it'd be fun to build a business around this. So we were pretty naive that way. And I think we gave ourselves a year at the time, saying that, hey, if nothing really comes out, at the end of the year, then we can just go back to our jobs. And our jobs at the time were largely related to, we were in a consulting firm. It was, around wrangling spreadsheets and PowerPoints, and we're pretty good at that. So what really happened is, for the first couple of years, we built a I think we built a handful of tools, but none of them really worked. None of them actually flew as a business. So we gave ourselves a year. 2 years later, we had nothing to really show for it. And we were, I would say it is putting it very mildly to say that we were getting very frustrated.
Okay.
One of the things that did happen during that time is we didn't really have any other financial support or venture funding. So what that meant is during those couple of years and all the failed products that we were building, we actually taught ourselves programming because, you know, we never professionally programmed before that. And that's a skill that came pretty handy, later on, because now we could actually build products ourselves, build them pretty quickly. And that's one of the things that was very useful. And RecruiterBox sort of happened incidentally. We built it over, a couple of weeks, and just to see if it would fly, and we showed it to a few people, and thankfully they kind of liked it, and they said, hey, okay, I would like to buy this outright, and I would like to use this.
Okay.
So but that really happened after 2 years of not having much for it, having to show much for our efforts. Once we did find a few customers for RecruiterBox, we could sort of viscerally say that, hey, there is something here, like this could actually be like a real business. This is something that people seem to appreciate. And just for context, what RecruiterBox really did is that it's a way for you to handle applicants who are applying to job openings in your company. So think of it as a CRM for hiring. If you're doing this without a tool, then what it usually means is that you're managing all of this in your inbox or in a spreadsheet. And once it gets over a certain level, it's really hard to keep track of all the people who applied to you, people who you need to get back to, collecting interview feedback across various people from your team, etc. Just becomes a hard thing. And RecruiterBox becomes like a system of record to keep you up to date and have a single place of truth about all of this information. So that's in a nutshell is what RecruiterBox did.
Okay.
And I think in the beginning we were just really happy that we have something that people are ready to pay real money for, and that sort of euphoria got us through a few months. But now we realize that we are in this phase where we need to figure out how to grow this thing. And we actually had a third co-founder join us at the time. So it was me, another technical co-founder, another one who was joining us on the business side. The three of us, for the first few months, we were just trying to grow the business. And we realized that there is a lot of inbound demand for this. People were looking us up on Google, finding us online, and sort of expressing interest in using this tool. So we sort of ran with that. We slowly set up something to do around SEO, set up the first set of things that need to happen so that people can actually sign up, use the product, and pay for it completely online without having to speak with us. And this happened roughly a year into us actually starting to build RecruiterBox. So that happened around that time. And to be completely honest, I was a skeptic around this whole SEO and inbound channel thing, because I always for some reason believe that, hey, we have competition that has deeper pockets than we do, and SEO looks like a zero-sum game to me, which means that whatever we can do, they can do 10 times better. So how are we ever going to find people like that? And somehow, thankfully, my co-founders convinced me to at least try it out.
Yeah.
And I grudgingly did. And within the first few weeks, we started seeing the results of this. We started seeing that the traffic on the website was going up and the number of signups was going up. And then I was hooked. Then we sort of put more effort into it, and SEO became our first and till the end the largest channel of way we were acquiring customers as we were growing. And from there on, I think few months in, we actually hired our first employee beyond the founders, and we started growing the team from there. And it was quite gradual because, we were quite conscious about making sure that we had 12 months of payroll for everybody who, at least 12 months of payroll for everybody who joins the company.
Yep.
So this was growing rather incrementally that way. And then one thing after the other was kicking in from either a standpoint of what we were doing on marketing, then from the product team started building out. And within us founders, we sort of you rotated and sort of evolved into different functions. So, to begin with, I, for example, was writing a lot of code. Then I moved to design, then product management, and then something in marketing, a little bit of sales. And one of the things that happens when you're running a bootstrap company is that you need to sometimes figure out functions before you can hire help to be able to run those functions independently, because you just don't have the bandwidth to hire those folks upfront. So including doing like customer support and everything else. Actually, customer support was something that we gave out the last, because we were very keen as founders to stay as close as possible to what the customer's voice was, and we sort of grew that out from there on. So I remember up until almost 2 years before we exited the company, I was still doing some customer support.
There's no better way to learn the business, though, is there, if you're moving into these different departments and doing it yourself before bringing somebody in? I mean, yes, you really have a grip on, a real handle on what's going on, don't you, rather than, I guess, the kind of the management by the rooftop when you've never really experienced it.
Yeah, it was really helpful, especially now that we are in a much more fast-growing setup. Having had the experience of doing these things hands-on and rolling up your sleeves at some point, I'm a little bit more intimately aware of what's involved in each of these functions than having like a 10,000-degree view of, or 10,000-foot view of these things.
Yeah. Did you find it hard? I mean, I know a lot of founders of startups, in the beginning, they're doing everything, aren't they? You're involved in everything, and then gradually over time you may be a little bit less in the trenches, and over time you're really removed. How did you find that?
I've heard that typically like a problem that happens where you start feeling the lack of control. Thankfully, that didn't happen between us founders at all. Like, for each of us, we were not worried so much about losing control as much as oftentimes there were some revision that we had to do, because as soon as you plug yourself out, suddenly the way that certain function was running may not necessarily happen as well, and it takes some time for it to get ironed out. So there was times where we had to come out and then go back in a little bit and then come out again and things like that. But all in all, I don't think it was hard emotionally, at least, of letting go of control. Like, I was reasonably happy doing that. I would rather have someone do it well. And we eventually, I think we were good at hiring, or we got good at hiring people that who were doing that function better than we ourselves were doing. So that really gave me some comfort.
And you mentioned that feeling of elation when you signed on those first few customers. I think when you moved on, when you sold the business, you had about 2,500 customers.
Yeah.
How did you manage that growth in customer base? And balance that with the employees, and make sure that you were giving the same level of service to those, the 2,500th customer as you were to the first few.
That was a bit of a challenge, right? And the growth happened relatively slowly. So, it wasn't exactly the hockey stick growth that you would see in a venture funded company. So we had some time while we were growing, though we were growing reasonably fast. I think one of the things that we did very well was we as the founding group were doing customer support till the very end, and that kind of gave us like a fire hose of information about what's really breaking, what are people pissed about, what's working well, and so on and so forth. So that was a important place to be in. What we were also doing as a product is the hardest problem happens as soon as you start acquiring more and more customers is if your business is set up in a manner that in order to service every new customer you're going to need more people, then it becomes harder. But we had sort of set up the business in a manner where it was self-served for the most part, to the point that we exited the company, I think about 70-80% of our customers would sign up, use a product for a trial, and make a paying decision without speaking to a human anywhere in the process. And we spent a ton of time and effort and energy to making sure the onboarding was really, really smooth. The product did a great job of helping people out understand what the product does, how it's valuable, and this was happening inside of the product. What that really meant is we were very efficient as a business, right? You didn't really need as many salespeople or as many onboarding people as you would need otherwise.
Mm.
And in spite of this, we were at a stage where we were getting, I think, somewhere between 80 to 100 support tickets a day. So we had a large support function, and we used to get a fire hose of information there. But I was reasonably happy about that. I'd rather be in a place where people are, venting out and telling you what's wrong than to be a place where people are just sterile and not even caring enough about the product that they're using. So
And Girish, do you think that's the key thing if you're really going to be able to scale a SaaS company sustainably without bringing on too much of manpower? Is that the key to have a product that is, you know, quite automated, there's not much friction there, and new users, new customers, existing customers can kind of self-serve?
Yes, I think that's definitely one of the, I think there is a name for it now. They call it product-led growth.
Mm-hmm.
I think a fancier name to explain the same things that we were doing back then. But yes, I think that's a great way of actually building a very efficient business and a very fast-growing business.
Yeah. And I just wanted to come back. You mentioned around SEO, being that real enabler, in terms of the inbound traffic, despite you being slightly pessimistic in the beginning. Were you doing that in-house, the SEO, or did you outsource that to a third party? And what was it specifically that, within the SEO that you think works so well?
In the end, it was like a combination of both stuff that we did in-house plus external help.
Okay.
Specifically at the beginning, what we realized is that the most important thing, apart from everything else that you'd also do in SEO, is to make sure your site is fast.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something was down my alley as an engineer by then. So we said, okay, this is something I know how to solve. So we actually made sure our site is fast, it loads fast, it works well on mobile, and those kind of things. And we immediately saw that, our rankings were improving on that.
Yeah.
Then we also hired a firm who helped us, write a bunch of content on the keywords that we were trying to rank on. So we started outsourcing some of that work, and then we hired agencies to help us with building links around our website and so on and so forth. So it was, and we eventually had an internal team to help us with these things as well. So every time when we had to do something completely new that we didn't have internal expertise around, we used to hire a firm to help us with the 0-1 journey. Then we would try and absorb some of that, run it internally to try and make the same process more efficient. That's the modus operandi that we had.
Okay. You scaled RecruiterBox to about 50 staff, and you mentioned earlier before we started recording that the current company Sprinto is also growing very quickly, and you're spending a lot of time on recruitment. Wondered if you had any advice to the listeners out there on how you do get it right when you're bringing in, people at an early stage, but then also people when you're going through, quite fast or rapid growth. How do you make sure that you're still as careful in the recruitment process? You're never going to get it 100% right, but is there anything you do to try and make sure you do bring in the right people?
Yeah, like you said, right, I'm not sure I got it 100% right, but in general, in my experience of hiring, I think I've realized that I would naturally over-index on people's experience before.
Okay.
And I've sort of learned to teach myself that, while it does help, the thing that I try and look out in people, especially when you're growing fast and you're trying to sort of build a team of people who can own things, is about the amount of hunger that they have. I've sort of had more luck with people who have a bit of a chip on their shoulder, they're out there to prove something, than people who have come with a ton of pedigree. They've done this before, and they look great on paper.
Mm-hmm.
So I've sort of made a conscious, I tell myself consciously that to discount that a little bit more and look for things about what drives this person, or are they actually hungry to do better, because each stint, its job is different, and it's while some of the things that you learned in your previous company you could apply here, but it is a little bit of 0-1 everywhere, and I think the people who can who have a little bit more hunger tend to do better than the people who are more skilled.
I like that, the way you said it as well. Some people with the bit of a chip on their shoulder and they've got something to prove are the ones that can come in and really, they push a little bit harder, don't they? They go the extra mile, and they're the ones that can make the biggest difference. Is there anything that you ask or look out for in the interview process to kind of spot that?
Nothing very specific, but okay. I try to, I do this thing in an interview where I try and make this more like a conversation, mm-hmm. and then less like an interrogation. The questions that usually tell me the answers to this is just quite simple stuff about, how they moved around in their previous companies, the things that they enjoyed doing there, the things that they didn't enjoy much, what they are looking to do in the next company, and how they describe those things tell you very clearly what they're looking for.
Okay.
So I don't have it down as a science yet, but I usually try to keep it as a very open-ended conversation,
yep.
and these things usually, when present, come through.
Okay. So I wanted to check. You've really been there and done it, and there's lots of kind of conflicting advice. But when you're going out and you're setting up a SaaS business, is there a commonly held belief that you hear other founders, other CEOs talking about that maybe you disagree with?
I don't know if this is as common a belief or as controversial as they say, but back when we were trying to start Sprinto about a couple mm-hmm. of years ago, there was this thing about building something quickly, putting it out there and see whether it works or not. And this is I think the common thing, which is about the whole lean startup methodology and saying that
build fast and fail fast. Yeah.
And I think that and we discussed this internally, and we had to think about what's the strategy to build Sprinto, and we kind of did the opposite thing at Sprinto, where we worked very closely with a few beta customers for the first 12 to 15 months before we started acquiring customers en masse. And the reason we did that, which was counterintuitive, from the way we did our previous company and from the way the common knowledge goes, is that we realized that the problem that we were going after was fairly well defined. Like, companies mm-hmm. need these compliances. We've been customers of that. We validated that. We know this. The real thing in our heads was about whether this can be built. So this happens as a manual exercise. Can you actually productize it? It was the main question. And to me, that was a product question. This was an engineering question. It has nothing to do with putting something out quickly and recognizing whether it works or not, because that is a thing that would not have worked for us. Mm-hmm. So we were very clear about this with our investors, saying that, hey, look, this is a high risk, high reward game. I believe that if we can actually productize this, this is a huge opportunity. What I have questions about and where I see the biggest risk is, can this be productized? And the way I'm going to mm-hmm. do this is, I'm going to spend the first 18 months or so just trying to see if we can build this. And if we can, then we have a great business, and we are ready to spend 5+ years on this, building this out. But if it turns out that the answer is no, I'd rather go and do something else, because I don't want to spend 5 years in a space where, you have half a product and it's half a service, and that's not really going to scale very fast.
No.
So I'd be happy to return money and whatever's remaining and go on to find the next thing that actually worth everyone's while.
Yeah.
So in a nutshell, yes, like I don't believe that, the thing about build fast, put it out fast works everywhere equally. There mm-hmm. are pockets of places where you might have to do the opposite thing, which is build it out a little bit more, validate that you can build out, given that the pain is well defined.
Yeah, yes. You want to make sure that there really is a tangible problem and you can meet the need of that problem before you decide that you're going to go away and spend years of your life and potentially a lot of your money on it.
Yeah.
So one thing many founders and CEOs overlook, and we've had a few other guests on the podcast that have spoken about this, and I was interested to get your take on it. I think one thing that still kind of got a bit of a "it won't happen to us" mentality is all around cybersecurity and cyber risk. I wanted to get your thoughts on how you can arm your CTO or CISO with the right framework to align security and compliance as a revenue generating item, rather than them just looking at it as a cost item.
Yeah, that's a great question. And this is very common, right? You think of yourself as a young company, and you're fighting different battles. Like, the highest level battle you're finding is about growing your business, and security probably falls somewhere low in that priority. What's really happening out there, though, in the market is that in the beginning, about 10 years ago, it was basically a Fortune 500 company would typically ask you some questions about your security practices, etc. And in the subsequent decade, the floor where you get asked for these things is constantly coming down. So in RecruiterBox, in my previous company, you know, we got asked this for some six-figure deals, and you know, that's where they would ask for, hey, do you have a SOC 2 and stuff like that. And like 5 years later, it's been asked for even, you know, like really, really small deals, like $10,000 and higher deals is you get asked for these kind of compliances. So the most important thing to understand about security and compliances is that at the end of the day, as a software business, you are handling your customers' data, and it is fair for them to ask you, you know, what are you doing with this? Are you keeping it safe? What if this data gets leaked? And this is becoming more and more of a table stakes now. This is no longer something that you only get asked, you know, in some obscure deals that happen here and there. So I believe that it's important to address this. In fact, if possible, I'm seeing more and more companies trying to do this, address this on the front foot rather than answer this defensively when the question comes up. So the way I would think about this is, you know, think of setting up a cybersecurity program as a revenue-making channel. Go on the in your sales pitch on your website, you can actually talk about the fact that you take this seriously. This is not an afterthought for you, because this is important for your customers, and this is one of the ways that you can stand out from your competition. This is one of the ways that you can wedge them out if possible, or this is one of the ways you make yourself look formidable and serious, you know, even as a young company, because as a young company, you often get asked these questions like, hey, how long have you been around? How many customers you have? And so on and so forth. These are just proxies for them to figure out, are you going to do something shady that's going to hurt my prospects, right?
Right.
So this is a great way for you to actually show yourself as a formidable vendor. And more companies are doing that. And, you know, in many cases, you're going to get asked for this anyway. So you might as well address it upfront rather than just defensively answering them if and when the question gets asked later in your sales cycle. You can actually go upfront in your sales pitch, in your website, and talk about the fact that, hey, look, we take security seriously. These are the practices and frameworks that we follow for it, and you know, you can trust your data with us. And that's like a great way of setting up context and setting confidence and assurance for your customers.
Yeah, and it's too easy, isn't it, I guess, to go to one of the competitors that are taking it seriously, and you don't want to lose out because of that.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, Girish, if you were starting again from zero today, how would you go about building a SaaS company from nothing to building it to attracting thousands of customers? And ultimately, I guess everyone wants to sell the business. What would be the three key things you would focus on?
I don't know if I have three, but I have one thing that I constantly remind myself of. That probably comes from my background as an engineer and a builder. So what usually happens for me is that if I put myself in the shoes of a person who is you know, going to start a new company, I'm usually very excited to go start building. You know, that's my DNA. Like I just love building stuff. So like I'm out there, you know, I just want to jump in and start building the product, write code. And one of the things that I've told myself, you know, to be wary of is to validate the problem. And we touched upon this briefly earlier, but you know, like I would rather be married to a problem than being married to a solution. And one of the things that starts happening is, as soon as you start building, the first time you write the first line of code, you're sort of getting married to the solution. And I'm a little wary of that because, you know, what ends up happening is that we have this way of reinforcing our beliefs. Once you start building out a product and you want it to succeed, and you try and sort of take any signal from the market to validate the fact that what you're building is useful and valuable and, you know, will be a great thing. So one of the things that I, so even while building Sprinto, we had 100 interviews before we wrote a line of code.
You
know, that was an important thing for me to do. I am naturally an introvert. I can't, you know, go out and talk to people, but we made it a point to actually have those interviews to validate the problem, to make sure it is real and, you know, not just in our heads, but out there in the market.
Yeah.
So that's the biggest thing that I would do again.
Yeah, I think that's That's very sound advice. Again, I mean, you don't want to, again, spend all that time, do you, and fall in love with the code if no one's ever going to buy the solution that you're working on. It's so worth investing that time, isn't it, on going out and talking to your ideal customer profile and really getting a handle on, do they have the problem that you're trying to solve and would they pay for it?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And you find that people, that it's strange that they don't go off and do that, isn't it? Or they feel that they can't ask those questions before they've got anything to show.
Yeah, I had a mental block around it, honestly. Like, I figured that, I was later surprised to see that people are quite forthcoming to do it. It was just something internally in my head that I wasn't doing it earlier.
Yeah, yeah. Girish, I've really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you very much for talking us all through your journey, how you built the company, how you exited, the time you're spending now with Sprinto. It sounds very exciting. You're growing very fast again. Congratulations. And giving us some advice on what you'd do if you were starting again today. Just before we finish, I always ask my guests if they can share one life or career lesson with the listeners.
I've sort of taught myself over the years to separate out, you can call them hopes versus expectations.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is, to me, a hope is something that, that is something that I'd like to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And an expectation is something which is about what's likely to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like I found it useful as a mental tool to separate the two out. What I mean by that is, when I have something as an expectation, it means that I've modeled the world around me in a certain manner. Like I feel like, I know this person or I know this system or I know this thing in a certain manner. And if it doesn't happen that way, then my model about that thing was wrong. And that's usually correction for myself to understand that, okay, like I got my model wrong. I need to revise it a little bit. And that's how you learn more and more about the world around you. Right. So that's something about expectation. But, that's not the same as hope. There are a bunch of things that you would like to happen that you don't have any clarity on, like when you're doing a startup, when you're doing something else, anything else. And the two tend to get mixed together. And I used to get very frustrated where, it could be something as simple as watching a game and your team that you support losing out. This is a prime example of something that I would like to happen, but I have absolutely no control or, I can't have an expectation that they would win. And I know it sounds very philosophical and very high level, but the fact that I can separate these two things out gives me a lot of peace of mind. Something that I hoped would happen doesn't happen, it doesn't bother me as much. Whereas when something that I expect to happen doesn't happen, it also doesn't bother me. It simply means that I need to go correct my mental model of those things. And the way I react to these things has become a lot more saner for me, as against to, it used to just get me angry and frustrated early on. So that's my simplest lesson.
I really like it. Thank you for sharing it. So Girish, how can people get in touch if they'd like to find out more?
I'm at girish@sprinto.com. Feel free to drop me a line. Would love to chat with you if any questions about running a startup, anything you think I can help you on. If you have any questions about specifically about cybersecurity or compliances, so hit me up at girish@sprinto.com.
Girish, thank you so much for coming on Digital Transformation and Leadership and sharing all of your insights and your experience with the listeners. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
I enjoyed this too, Danny. Thanks for having me.
You've made it to the end of another episode of Digital Transformation and Leadership. If you're enjoying the show, please do leave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. No need to leave a written review, just clicking on the 5 stars is enough. I'd really appreciate it as it helps the show get found and it helps those listener numbers grow. And we'll be back again next week when we will again go behind the scenes with another top business leader to understand how they're digitally transforming their company. The Digital Transformation and Leadership Podcast is a Blue Aurora Media production.